right, so welcome to Please Leave a Message. I'm your host, Richard McLean. Jess, sadly, isn't in again. He's not going to be in for a while. So I have conscripted various people to come help and co-host.
His loss is our win.
Yeah, exactly.
So this week I have...
Jason Knoll.
And Matthew Skaggs.
All right. So how's it going, guys?
Great.
Pretty good.
Really happy to be here.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thanks for being so excited about it.
Yeah.
What's up this week?
Matt just moved into a new place.
Yeah.
Moved out of his parents' basement.
Yeah.
All right.
Like a real grown man now.
He's a real boy.
Just moved into a new opium den. Oh, it's pretty sweet. It's a pretty sweet gig.
So my news is that my website is down. It's sad. WeirdAlGame.com is not accessible at the moment. Well, it's accessible, but you get a big white blank nothing. Mm-hmm. My web server upgraded their operating system, and it's not compatible with my content management system.
Yay for upgrades.
So everything broke. So we're trying to get that resolved. It's kind of a bad time because I just applied for FanX in March, and if they go to my site and see nothing, I might not get in. Mm. I'm not sure I've got the $200 though, so it might not be a bad thing. So we like to start every episode with a greeting for those of you out there that have birthdays this week. Jess has found a song for you.
It's your day, it's your time, it's your birthday. It's your day, it's your time, it's your birthday. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday to you.
It's actually my birthday this week.
All right. Happy birthday, Jason.
Thank you. We're going to go see Arrival.
Yep.
And eat ramen.
Eat ramen. Booyah.
Oh, that movie looks awesome.
I know, I'm excited for it. Super excited.
Do love me a good
going to Rogue One for work, so I figured I'd save that for work.
And I think I might get to go to Rogue One for work, too.
Yeah, they're taking us to barbecue in Rogue One, which is going to be a great day.
I have to wait a couple days till I get to see Rogue One, which I'm really sad about. But family's in town, bought tickets for them for Christmas. It's my Christmas gift to my family. Go see Rogue One together.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Star Wars is a family movie, so.
Yeah, it is.
Totally. Family story. It's all about family.
It's true, it is.
Yeah, it's true.
It is.
Yeah. So, what's your theory about Rey's lineage? Who
do you think? My theory is I don't care, and I will find out when I find out.
I think Rey's a Kenobi. I'm pretty convinced.
I think Rey is a character in the movie that will end up having ties to someone.
Yourself a Star Wars fan.
Well, I'm a fan. I'm just sort of speculating.
You're not theorizing and speculating.
I've read all the theories. I just don't agree with most of them.
Yeah, well,
I think some of them are kind of ridiculous. A little far-fetched.
Most of them.
Yeah.
That's fan theory dumb, though.
So true. Our interview this week... Mm-hmm. Oh, whose phone was that?
It's yours.
It's mine. I had a panic moment. I'm like, why is that blinking? Why is it disconnected? Oh, yeah. I shut the computer down. When it does that at work, I have to reboot. Because I'm running, I have a Mac at work, but I'm running Windows on it.
Oh, yeah.
And so FireWire
way to do it.
Has to be connected from the very beginning. You can't plug it in later. I moved in and they said, here's your brand new trash can Mac. And I'm like, I've never seen one of those
before.
Do
you like it?
It runs Windows great.
Yes, it does. Macs run Windows very well. They do.
Don't make no sense.
Windows runs better on a Mac than it does on a PC, in my experience.
I know computers well enough that if I have a problem, I can generally fix it.
Yeah.
Typically. Pro Tools, on the other hand?
Of course, I usually use crappy PCs.
Yeah.
I'm tearing my hair out over it.
Yeah, Pro Tools is it's a hair loss technique.
Yeah. That is so true.
Got too much hair?
Use Pro Tools.
Pro Tools. That's the opposite of Rogaine.
Right now, we are asking people to call in to our number. You can call us and leave a message. Phone number is 801-382-7672. And we want people to tell us jokes. Just call in, tell us your best joke, and we'll, in a couple episodes, we'll feature the best of the best.
That's a sweet idea.
Yeah.
I'm a joke kind of guy.
No, you're not. No.
Shut up.
Joke kind of people are funny.
You're not nice.
But But you like puns.
I do like puns.
I like puns myself.
It's dad humor.
I also surrounded like jokes. By dads. Like regular jokes.
Surrounded by dads.
I am a dad.
Yeah, so I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm surrounded by dads. I just said that.
But I liked puns before I was a dad.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah. I always thought it came with the first, the moment the kid comes out, you're like, start telling puns, finding them funny for some reason. The worst joke my dad ever told, I remember it, because we gave my dad so much crap for it for so long. My mom was like, I'm making chicken cordon bleu for dinner. And he was like, oh, I prefer chicken cordon red. And not a single person laughed in the entire room. And we all sat there in silence for a while. And then the only sound you could hear was my brother facepalming.
Well, I liked it.
Mm-hmm. I would have laughed.
Yeah.
So this week's interview is with Brance Woolsey. He's a local artist. Here we go.
All right, Brance, thanks for coming down.
Yeah, of course.
Agreeing to be part of our show. So this part of our show, it's called iTick.
Is it a subsidiary of Apple? Is it an Apple product?
No, never.
A little iTick.
Well, that's funny. I didn't even think of that when I came up with the name. No, so what we do is we have some set questions that we ask everyone. It's just kind of to try and figure out what makes people tick.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us your name and tell us what you do?
So I'm Brance Woolsey. Brance Michael Woolsey, BMW, you know.
Nice.
My parents figured it was the only BMW they'd ever have, so they went with it.
Nice.
And it really wasn't intentional, but I work at the Springville Museum of Art. I do marketing for them, and I like to draw. I like to hang out with friends, listen to music, do all sorts of stuff. I'm just kind of, I'm a little bit of jack of all trades. I could tile a floor if somebody needed it, or figure out how to fix a car. When I started the projects, I didn't know that I was going to be able to do it, but then I just figured out how to do it and have done it. So
very cool.
It's kind of fun. You know, I've thought about maybe going into some, using my business experience and going into some sort of field where I can use my hands more, because I really enjoy the work that I do with my hands. So
okay. Tell us about your earliest memory.
Ooh, so I'm not sure what my earliest memory would be. I know that, like, my earliest memories that I do remember, they're from when my family lived in Phoenix, Arizona. I remember that was where I learned to ride a bike, where I got my first bike. I don't know that I still had training wheels down there. I learned to ride it actually in St. George. But
okay.
I was a crazy little kid down there. My parents always had me running away. I was always figuring out new ways to get to the neighbor's house or to get what I wanted. There was one time we were visiting family, and I was a night owl from really early on. So I would watch David Letterman with them. And we were visiting family one time, and my parents were trying to put me to bed, and I was like, but Mom, I haven't seen Dave's Top 10 yet. That was the time to go to bed. After Dave's Top 10, it was time for bed.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So that's just something. But I would also wake up in the middle of the night when I was little and ask to watch movies. And sometimes we had some neighbors across the street, and we had I think it was Aladdin. It might have been something else, but I'm pretty sure it was Aladdin. And we loaned it to the neighbors across the street. And in the middle of the night, I woke up and I wanted to watch it. And my parents, my mom went over and got the VHS. And I was just a little demon. I've mellowed out since then. But I'm pretty sure that my kids are going to be little hellions. But one of the earliest memories that I have, which goes along with being a hellion, is we were at Disneyland. And I was trying to, like, get up to the characters. Because they used to not have, like, specific parts of the park where right. All the characters would be. They would all be, like, up on Main Street. And you could try to push forward. But there were always, like, huge throngs of people all around. Around the characters, and I was a little kid, and my dad has a videotape of it. He was videotaping. I was trying to push forward to get to the characters, but I kept getting pushed back by other kids and families that were getting pictures with the characters. And the guy who was playing Captain Hook noticed that I was getting pushed out of the way, so he came over and grabbed my hand and, like, walked me over to the side and, like, gave me special attention. So I've always had an affinity for Captain Hook. You know, he's the true hero of Peter Pan.
Nice.
He's the one, you know, everything falls down on him, and he was just trying to do what he felt was right.
How old do you think you were when that happened?
Ooh, probably three or four.
That's funny because my earliest specific memory is at Disneyland.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I was about three.
Yeah, I almost lost my hat on Big Thunder Mountain Railroad that trip. I remember my mom, for some reason, my mom's really terrified of windmills.
Okay.
She just thinks they're creepy, like something from an H.G. Wells novel, or, you know, they have those long spindly propellers that could fly off and crush a car. So she just gets freaked out about them. And I remember, because we lived in Arizona, and the road from Arizona to Anaheim, from Phoenix to Anaheim, there's a part of the way that there's tons of windmills.
Okay.
And so I remember my mom, like, not liking those. And then I was a little kid, and I was, like, trying to point out to my mom, oh, no, look, don't look, Mom, there's windmills. But I was just drawing attention to all of them.
Right.
So.
Trying to be helpful.
Trying to be helpful, but not really.
That's awesome. All right. Speaking of childhood, do you have another, like a specific story that is highly influential in your life and something that's happened, but maybe you don't share it a lot?
So when, I'm trying to think how old I was probably 8 or 9. We lived in this house in Castledale, Utah. Me and my family, we moved there when I was about 5. So I might have been only like 8 when this happened. We were living in this small little white house next to the library there. We had this big barn in our backyard. There was a loft in the top of the barn, and we were always curious about what was up there, and we always wanted to get up there. And it was at least 2.5 stories tall to get up to that loft. So one day, my dad was borrowing a ladder from a neighbor to do some tree trimming in the front yard, and we asked him if we could use that ladder to get up in the loft, and he said, no, I'm not going to let you use the ladder, but if you guys figure out a way to get up there, then I'll let you guys make a fort up there.
Okay.
So me and my little brother and my best friend from across the street, we found these two really long planks that would reach up to the loft. So they were probably 25 feet tall, these two planks. And so we laid those two planks going up to the loft. And then we started to get other boards. And most of it probably wouldn't be OSHA approved or anything. But it was mostly old barn wood and stuff.
Okay.
But we found some old nails in this shed behind one of my friend's houses. We went and, like, just took them from this shed. It was this old storage shed that hadn't been cleaned out for years, and there were all sorts of old boxes. The nails were probably from, like, the 50s or something. They were all rusty, and the box was falling apart. But we took those nails and just pounded in 2 or 3 nails on each side and just, like, started at the bottom and just climbed it as we nailed the new rungs onto this ladder and got up to the loft and made the best fort known to man.
Nice.
We got couch cushions from an old couch that was out on the road and put them up there. And we had a styrofoam box that we could use as a fridge. And we had a shoe box full of old wires and screws that we called the Imagination Station.
Okay.
So you'd open it up and take something out of it, and that was your game.
Okay.
And then you'd just imagine a game and play it. And you'd just, like, talk through it with your friends and say, oh, you know, I'm doing this thing. And then your friend would be like, oh, I'm defending you and helping you out. It was a really fun time. It was just one of those cool moments where it was like my dad could have given us a ladder to get up there.
Right.
But he wanted us to use our imaginations and make it something that was more memorable for us.
That's really
so
cool.
It was like teaching a man to fish. Right. So he taught us to fish, and, you know, I don't think any of us have stopped. We all have our own creative endeavors that we all still go after. So
it's fantastic.
It's a good time.
I love it. Do you have a piece of music you can share with us that's been highly influential in your life?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I know for me that's hard because
there's so much music. There's so much good stuff. For a little while there's a song by a Utah artist named Stephanie Maybe. I think it's called Wake Up Dreaming, but it's about this guy who has this boring desk job, but then all of his breaks at work he uses to draw these comic characters and these adventures that are just amazing. So it's a beautiful song. Yeah. So yeah, it's called Wake Up Dreaming by Stephanie Maybe. She also has a lot of other good songs. She has one called The Zombie Love Song. And
I think I've heard of that one.
Yeah, and I think she just came out with a new album. That was her only album for a while. The album was actually called Wake Up Dreaming as well. But I think she just came out with a new album.
Cool.
It's a cool song. Really, really awesome lyrics. I'll pull some up here. It talks about how there's people that come into the shop that he works at, and he can't shake the feet. Like, they don't know who he really is and, like, what he is capable capable of, his potential. But he's able to fulfill like this higher potential. So it says, to hit them, he's just the guy who rings them up. And he can't shake the feeling that this whole world's asleep. He's full of vision no one else can see. But soon he'll make it real, because he knows how to keep believing. Wake up dreaming. So
cool.
It's a cool song.
How did that influence you?
I first learned about that song in 2013. I had just recently gone through a lot of different changes in my life. I had come home from an LDS mission the year before. I was engaged and then disengaged. And then there were just a lot of things happening. I was going to college. I was learning a lot there. Some of my worldviews were changing. Some of them were developing more. So I was just learning a lot of things. And I kind of became really skeptical about a lot of things. And that song helped me to maintain that almost childlike, like those childlike things that you want to maintain, sort of the humility, the imagination, the joy of little things that happen in the world and that happen around you. And that song helped me to remember those things and to keep that in mind in just the day-to-day.
Very cool.
So
all that inner child stuff that you don't want to lose.
That light, that driving force.
Right.
That anything's possible if you just start doing it.
Exactly.
So
many people lose that.
Yeah. And, you know, a kid will sit down and start drawing something, and it's a masterpiece to them. And nobody tells them otherwise, you know, if they bring it to you and say, look at my amazing artwork. You're not going to say, that's not amazing. and it's sad that as adults, we don't do the same thing, you know. We don't claim our own works as amazing very often. That's something that I'm working on doing still. I'm not very good at doing that yet, but it's something that I want to get back to.
I know I personally have like a threshold, and if I hit that, I'm happy.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, I've been doing Inktober this year.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a few days where it's like 11:30 at night, and I'm like, I've been so busy today. I have not done anything. So I whip something up, and it's like, I know that one's not great, but I was going to do this every day no matter what.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. So
yeah, it's hard to keep that consistency sometimes too.
And then like, the funny thing is like, the ones that I do get to spend at least an hour on,
mm-hmm.
I'm happy with,
yeah,
for the most part, until I look at everybody else's Inktober. And then I'm just like, ugh. Because there's like a couple different kind of inking styles that I really like,
mm-hmm.
that I've never really been able to capture.
Yeah.
So I know how that is.
Yep.
Do you have another piece of media that's been really influential to you? And this can be a piece of music or a movie or a comic book or just a board game, just whatever.
Yeah. You know, it's usually the last thing that I've watched or listened to or read. I get really on like big tracks for a little bit after I finish a piece. Really influential. I love Darwin Cook's Parker adaptations in graphic novel form. So it's the Richard Stark Parker novels. It's just classic noir novel.
Okay.
Darwin Cook adapts them as comics and graphic novels. It's sad we lost Darwin Cook earlier this year. He passed away, but he's an amazing artist and did just a really good job with the style and everything with those graphic novels.
Okay.
So I love those. I really do love noir, just the detective stuff. There's a twist and you always know the twist is coming, but you never know what it is. And even if you do know what it is, you just feel like you're a smarter person because you're the detective that figured it out. So there's so much to those detective stories. I love just consuming those.
Right.
Recently, I've been reading a lot of Chuck Klosterman novels. He wrote, one of his most famous books is Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs.
Okay.
And it's a book of essays about like low culture things. So he talks about MTV's The Real Life, and he talks about Billy Joel and how Billy Joel is a rock star that wasn't trying to be cool, and he wasn't trying to not be cool and still being cool. Because a lot of rock stars, they're like, oh, I'm so uncool, I'm cool. Or they're, oh, I'm so cool.
Right.
And Billy Joel was just like, let's do this.
Yeah.
he didn't really care about that whole persona thing. So he talks about Billy Joel and what he means as figure in society. And he talks a lot about all sorts of other things. He talks about Pamela Anderson and what she means. And it's really fun. Like, I don't always agree with him, but I am always interested in the way he expresses his ideas. He's got a lot of great ideas.
Right.
Right now I'm reading a book of his where he talks about villains.
Okay.
And where we encounter villains in real life and what constitutes a villain. And it's just really interesting. He's like, well, you know, a serial killer can't really be a villain because they're subpar, they're not really human. They they've kind of lost anything that makes them human. And he talks about other people. He talked about Andrew Dice Clay, the comedian from the early 90s. And one of his prevailing ideas is he talks about the different people, people like Julian Assange and Kim.com and all sorts of people through all decades. He says that what makes a villain really is people who know a lot but care very little. And that idea is just really interesting to me. He presents a lot of other ideas in his books. He has one that's called Killing Yourself to Die, where he went on this trip to visit all these famous places where rock stars passed away. As he visits the places, he just writes down his thoughts about, like, that rock star, things that they could have meant. And he analyzes his relationships as he goes on this trip and kind of comes up with these conclusions about who he is and about who these rock stars are and how sometimes the best career choice is to die. Because there's so many people that become famous after they die, and they, you know, they die in poverty, sad, because they haven't been fulfilled in their art or whatever.
Right.
So he just presents so many interesting ideas. I've just loved everything I've read of his.
It's interesting. Yeah, the whole villain thing, like, to me, I always, when I look at a villain, villains think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Typically. You know, they don't think of themselves as a villain. They see themselves as the hero.
Yeah.
It's kind of the interesting thing to me.
And it can fit into that concept that he's come up with where it's people who know a lot. They know a lot and they're trying to do the right things. Someone like Julian Assange, who did WikiLeaks. He knows a lot of stuff, but he cares very little about what the consequences of that action could be. So he knows something and he wants to put it out in the world and he wants people to know about it. But does he care about what the consequences might be of that action? And I think a lot of it really does boil down to that idea. I'm excited to finish the book. I'm in the middle of it right now, so...
The conclusion hasn't been drawn yet.
I don't know what his concluding thoughts on being a villain are, but that's kind of the prevailing thought through what I've read so far.
Okay, it's really interesting.
And then just for good measure, I need to add one of the best works of art, media, entertainment is Craig Thompson's book, Blankets.
I've read that.
That graphic novel blew me away. That was... So in my freshman year of college, I had taken a hiatus from reading comics. I kind of viewed them as... like low culture and, I don't know, childish through high school. I'd really enjoyed them up till like ninth grade. And then I had that 3-4 year period there that I didn't really read any comics and didn't seek them out like I had before. But I had a friend at college my freshman year who loaned me a copy of that book and it blew me away. I was very overwhelmed by just the beauty of the art and the simplicity, but also depth of the storytelling and how much Craig Thompson was able to convey to the reader throughout that whole book. There were a lot of feelings that I identified with and that I really enjoyed and other parts that maybe I didn't so much, but I was able to feel for the characters in the book, feel for Craig as I read that. So
yeah, that I think that was the first graphic novel I read that was autobiographical.
Yeah.
And since then I've read quite a few, but I think that's the first one that I read that was autobiographical. And the thing that it impressed on me was like how naked he was to the world.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he was just put it all out there. Like if I was to do an autobiographical graphic novel, I don't think I could be that honest in my feelings and portrayals of myself.
Yeah.
I was just, that's really what it impressed upon me was just how open he was with just the things he'd been through.
Yeah.
And again, yeah, I don't identify with some of the things he went through. Like his conclusions and my conclusions are not the same, but it's interesting to see his point of view.
Yeah. I would love, like, reading that, it made me have this really big fascination with nonfiction and creative nonfiction storytelling. That's why I like Chuck Klosterman. His essays are all kind of nonfiction.
Okay.
I really love, I think it's David Smalls is his name. He's the author of a graphic novel called Stitches, but that book's really amazing. It's about, as a kid, he lost some of his vocal cords because of some treatments that were being done to him to try to get rid of this sickness that he had. His dad was a doctor, and so they did like this radiation treatment that he really probably should have gone through, and then he had to have some of his vocal cords removed because of it. But he learned to express himself through art Okay. And that was something that was really beautiful to me. And I love listening to stuff like This American Life and Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People, podcasts like that. There's just so much good nonfiction artwork and entertainment in the world. And I love to consume that stuff. I love true stories that I could say, oh, this thing happened to this person in this place, and this thing happened to another person in this other place, and they're kind of connected this way. I love drawing those connections and learning that stuff. And I also want to be able to learn and teach myself more how to be candid and tell my own stories to the world, because I know everybody has experiences that can help other people, and I want to be able to tell my stories and help other people.
Very cool. Tell us about your passion and why you do it.
Well, my passion is life.
Okay.
And I do it because I'm afraid of the alternative.
Okay.
So I am a little bit afraid of death, so I try to live the best I can before then. You know, I do have religious beliefs and hope in the afterlife and all of that. I don't have a perfect knowledge of that or like a strong, I don't know, base in that. But I believe and I hope for beautiful things in a life to come. You know, with those religious beliefs comes that idea that you need to do well with the time you have living. So I try to make the most of everything. I try to take advantage of opportunities that might pop up. I randomly decided to do an internship in Washington, D.C. with a congressman, and it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. I applied on a whim to get a job at an art museum, and before that I applied on a whim to get a job at a publishing company. And both of the jobs that I filled in those places were jobs in the field that I graduated in and from college, and it was just awesome being able to work in those fields and learn about publishing and learn about the fine art world and be able to be uplifted by the works of other people and be able to help them to get their stories to the world. And that's something that is a theme that I guess has been prevalent in my life a lot, is I like to help other people tell their stories. I worked one summer doing simple cameraman stuff and interviews for a television company out in Emory County, Utah. And that was a blast, being able to go and interview people and let them tell their stories about their life. And then as a marketing support specialist for authors, I was able to help them get the word out about the stories that they had written and tell their story as an author to get their books to sell and help them with that. And then with the museum, I've been able to learn so much about the art of Utah, early art of Utah. How it's progressed, how it's gotten to where it is now. I've been able to see the art community of Utah come together and support each other. It's really interesting seeing all the posts of the artists of Utah, how they support and go to each other's shows and really help out. And hopefully the consumer base for that continues to grow. They've already got a pretty all right consumer base for their fine art, but I hope that continues to grow. But I also love just being able to work on my own art and do my drawing and also writing and share that with the world through Comic Jam with Jess, and there's a open mic night in Provo at Enlightened Bakery, and they do an awesome job there. So I just love all of that stuff. It's really fun to be able to participate in such a thriving art scene, being able to go to listen to bands at Velour that are coming up and be able to talk to those creative minds and just grab a little bit of what makes them tick.
Yeah, it's so... I met you through Comic Jam with Jess.
Yeah.
And then because you work at the museum, I actually submitted a piece for the first time ever to a show, and I got in. That's something I've thought about doing a really long time, and it was kind of a whim. I was like, I think I've got something that could fit that show sitting around here. So I just framed it up and submitted it on a whim and got in, and that I want to do more now.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I really do love the art community here. I lived up in Salt Lake before we moved down here, and I literally just felt like an island.
Yeah.
I felt like there was nobody I knew that did that kind of stuff. I knew that there was kind of a community like that, but I just didn't really feel like I fit into it up there.
Yeah.
I never wanted to go do the kind of things that they did. Down here, there's stuff all the time.
Yeah, they've got like Creative Collaborative at the Provo Rec Center and so many other things. Just always have events going on for creative people to, yeah. to get together and network and help each other out.
So, yeah, and, like, so I'm, like, I'm not a fine artist mm-hmm. at all.
Same.
You know, I've, in high school, I won the Best Commercial Artist Award. Like, I've always geared my art kind of, well, my art's really cartoony.
Yeah.
First of all, and second of all, just I've never, I enjoy the fine art world mm-hmm. to a degree. there's a threshold that it hits, and when it gets there, I'm just like, all right, you've hit my pretentious, I can't go with you to this area that you've gone to. I was noticing that, like, my description of my art uh-huh. was just straightforward, just described exactly what I had drawn.
Yeah.
And then other people...
It was very interpretive.
Yeah, very interpretive and very, like, flowery and just kind of went on and on for three paragraphs and didn't... It said something, but, I mean, really, it didn't really say anything.
Well, and... Personally, I, you know, a little bit of interpretive is good for people to be able to look at it and say, okay, you know, this is what the artist is trying to say. But I feel like a lot of what should come from the art is the viewer's response to it and what it makes them feel. And that's something that, as I've been at the museum, working with Dr. Rita Wright, who's the director, she's been able to help me grasp, like, how to help people look at art and decide what it means for them instead of trying to tell them, oh, this is what it means.
Right.
And I think that that makes art more powerful is when people are able to consume it and say, okay, this is what it means to me. You know, there could be a simple illustration of a church or a temple or other holy site that you put on a wall. And some people are just going to walk past it because it has no meaning to them. But others, it's going to be something that touches them just to the very heart of who they are.
And I think another aspect of it is, like, knowing the artist. So, like, there was a piece there from an artist who I know, and I was looking all over to see if he was there.
Yeah.
He wasn't, as far as I could see. I haven't seen him in 10 years.
Who was it?
Rob Adamson.
Okay.
And it was just a little painting. He paints cityscapes.
Oh, cool.
And he likes to go and get, like, those old big signs from, like, the 50s.
Uh-huh.
And just things that are just rotting away. And he likes to capture those before they're lost forever.
Yeah.
But the piece that he had there last night was... It was a cityscape. But it was nighttime. And it was from up and above the city.
Oh, the Salt Lake one with the lines and the bright lights. Yeah, yeah, I love that piece.
I saw that and I knew it was his before I even saw his name there.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, oh, Rob. I know Rob. And like I don't know if I would have liked that piece as much if I didn't know him personally.
Well, I know that personally on that piece, I love the way that the light is shown and everything. It's a striking piece.
It is, yeah. He's got a piece that's New York Taxis.
Oh, that's cool.
At night in the rain. Mm. That's just incredible.
That sounds amazing.
But and the funny thing is, that's not typically the kind of stuff I like. But just because I know him personally and I know what he puts into it, it just, because of that, it means more to me.
Yeah.
I think is interesting.
That's cool.
All right, Brantz, what makes you tick?
Well, clocks. I think just the desire to always be learning new things, learning about people, and helping people to tell their stories. I think that those things make me excited. They help me live my life more fully. Just being around people, learning who they are, and being able to share their stories and help them share their stories. I think that that's... I don't know that there's much else that really pushes me forward. You know, I love just doing that. It's a good time.
If people want to contact you, see your art, or, you know, hire you for something, or just to get to know more, how can people find you or contact you?
A lot of the information on that is on my Tumblr page. It's Brantz Woolsey. It's BRANTZWOOLSEY.tumblr.com. I'm also on Instagram, and I post art regularly there, and it's at Brantz Woolsey, spelled the same way. And I'm on a project right now. We don't release too many comics. I need to actually do my comic for this month. I'm 5 days late. I just realized that as we were talking. I have a draft for it, so I know where it's going. I just need to ink it and color it and put it online. But it's Skeleton Bros Comics. It's me and a friend from high school. We decided we would start doing comics to kind of push each other creatively and keep creating and have an outlet where we could hold ourselves accountable. But I need to obviously hold myself a little more accountable.
Don't we all?
But brantzwoolsey.tumblr.com. It has links to any other place where my artwork can be seen, and It also has links to articles of places where my name has been featured or like a tweet of mine has been featured. I have an article that is a tweet of mine from when I was watching Sharknado 3. So I was in like the Florida Review or something. I don't remember what newspaper it was. And then there's also one from when I was in the bacon barter. So Oscar Mayer did a publicity stunt where they had a guy travel across the nation with a truck full of bacon, and he had to trade his way all the way across from New York to LA. Like, to get gas, he had to give someone bacon, and then they would buy the gas for his truck.
That's wild.
And so I traded a little like DI jacket for 32 bricks of bacon. It was glorious.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming down and being part of the show.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
It was a fun time. I really enjoyed myself.
Awesome.
I know that name, Brant Woolsey.
Brant Woolsey?
Yeah, who is he?
Brant? Apparently he's an artist, and he's been on a podcast before.
Oh, some podcast.
So that's our interview with Brant. He's a good guy. So tell us a little bit about who you guys are.
Okay, I'll start.
Take a really deep breath, because there's a lot.
Well, I'm Jason. I run an audio company called H2 Audio. I do a lot of live sound and a lot of recording and production, things like that. And I was the producer for this album that you have in front of you here, Raise the Goat.
Hallelujah.
And we have, to your listening pleasure, here with us, Matthew Skaggs, who is the founder.
The Matthew Skaggs.
The Matthew
Thank
Skaggs.
You very much.
He is the founder and the lead singer and the brain...
The everything.
...behind Cold Year.
There's a bassist and a drummer. We won't mention them.
They're pretty cool, I guess.
They're all right. They're okay. Yep. My name's Matthew Skaggs. I'm a musician by trade and by life. Play guitar, sing, teach guitar lessons.
Sometimes he remembers his lyrics.
Sometimes I remember my lyrics. I also have done some session work with some local artists. Not too much is happening right now, but hopefully in the future those albums will be coming out, honestly.
The Cold Year's on hiatus currently while the drummer has a baby.
Yeah.
So, as in his wife has a baby.
Yeah, his wife just had a baby. Theodore. This is the name of the baby. Theodore Jones.
Dad's name is Columbia, so, you know, if that gives you anything.
Yeah. Yep. So, and, that's pretty much me. That's pretty much all about me you need to know.
All right. So if we were to play a song off of this album for our listeners.
I think probably the best song to choose would be one called Guillotine. It's kind of the fan favorite, if you will.
Yeah. The Guillotine, awesome, says the lead singer of the band.
Awesome, says the producer.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. I love this album, and I helped make it. So if I helped make it and I love it, that's saying something.
That's pretty good, because usually by the end, you're so sick.
I still have this on repeat.
Yeah,
I love it.
And honestly, it's the same thing for me. I recorded an EP when I was just a solo artist, and honestly, I go back and listen to that and just go, ugh, bleh. But I go back to Praise the Goat all the time. Like, sometimes I'll just be driving in the car, and I'll just be like, I want to listen to Praise the Goat, like any other album. So, because my philosophy when it came to the band was I wanted to make music that I would like. Like, if the Cold Year existed outside of myself, the Cold Year would be my favorite band. So they're making the music that I want to hear. They have the same philosophy.
Imagine that.
As far as that, I know. So. And I've noticed that some musicians don't do that. Like, some musicians are like, yeah, I make music. It's alright, I guess, you know? It's like, no, you should believe in everything you do, and you should say, this is the greatest song ever written every time you write a song. In my opinion, but I am very pretentious.
Alright, well, let's give this a listen.
Of a soul, I'll overthrow and become your lord. Fall on your knees and worship me. I have become your only king. I'm not alone, a church built upon where I can place my only throne. I'll be your king if you be my queen. Of a Lord. crucible. You give me doubt, it's so beautiful. I am a king, and what I need is a boy for my legacy. The church is wrong, I'm no pawn. Let's go and reform and make our own. I'll be your king if you be my queen. And comes the guillotine. I've heard I killed them all. I'm in pursuit of something new, and I'm at war with more than a few. I will reform, start a quarrel, until a baby boy is born. I'll be your king if you be my queen. Then comes the guillotine.
Yeah!
if you listen to that on a full system with a sub, the bass is meant to bury you. It's really heavy bass in there, and it's awesome.
Out there, I've got two subs.
Yeah.
Hooked up.
You'll have to listen to it later on.
So,
That one in Salted Floor is the same way.
Yeah, because we wanted to bury you
on
Salted Floor, which is the last track of the album.
Which is one for a whole other podcast. That's we can spend an entire podcast talking about that song alone. So,
well, cool. Well, tell us a little about what we just listened to.
Matt?
Well, The Guillotine is, I would describe it as like the first song The Cold Year wrote, as in like we all wrote it as a band. I came in with a guitar riff that I was kind of playing with, and our drummer at the time, Greg, was like, ooh, I've got an idea for that. So he threw in the 2-4 part, you know, at the beginning where it's just bah, bah, you know, on the 2 and the 4. And then, you know, and then I came in with the 1-3, you know, on there. So it was like the first song that we wrote as a band. You know, before that, it was Matthew Skaggs and The Cold Year. You know, they were performing my solo music as a backing band. But
it was almost more like alt folk blues, experimental blues music, and
but it
kind of started evolving into like a jazzy gypsy kind of sound after that.
So. And so because I always loved gypsy jazz, and so I was using the chord structure in that song is very gypsy, and that uses sixths and major sevenths and minor sevenths, all that, you know, technical shizzle.
All that jazz.
Yeah. And so that's kind of how that came to be.
Can you guess what the song's about from listening to it?
I cannot, the first time I listened to a song ever.
Okay.
I mean, here comes the guillotine, you know, pretty obvious there, but it's about King Henry VIII and the fact that he liked to kill his wives.
Because they wouldn't give him sons.
They wouldn't birth him sons. Because I write... That's probably one of the weirdest songs I've ever written, because I tend to write more personal songs as far as telling stories, you know, about things that I've experienced and things that I'm keen on. And one of the things I'm very keen on is history. I love history and I love studying it. And so the story of King Henry VIII has always been super fascinating to me. So I wrote a song about it because I know it really well and I really enjoy that kind of that world. So I write songs about personal things, and that era and that kind of story is very personal to me. So,
So at the end of it there, we decided to kind of just move it into Rag because the feedback and the structure of the next song, it just kind of felt right to have it just move straight into that song.
The other thing is, you know, Rag is about, you know, people rising up against a king, you know, and fighting, you know, revolt, basically. And so I felt like these two songs went beautifully together because one is about a king and his... kind of, I can do whatever I want. I'm going to kill all these women because they won't give me a son, you know? And the other one is about the people and revolting and fighting.
And being revolting.
Being revolting. So I felt, and that, and just, I don't even remember how that came to be, like how, like when we decided to like have them lead into the
You know, I think we just played them back to back.
I think so.
And it just sounded good.
Yeah.
So we just kind of stuck with it.
Yeah. And
that was the plan from day one, is to make those play together.
Yeah, because we followed kind of the, what is it called? The storytelling, the wave of storytelling or whatever it's called, you know, where you have rising action, then you have climax and you have falling action and then finale, you know. And so we have
story arc.
The story arc. So that's what it follows, is the beginning of Hades is a pulsing, moving song that's kind of always building and building and building. And then you have another song that's a little same thing, kind of constantly moving up, up and up. And Guillotine and Rag feel like that's like the climax of the album. And then the songs after that tend to be, they slow down a lot.
Resolution.
And then Salted Floor tops off the album with a really quiet, super sad
song. Salted Floor is about getting stabbed. So it's a little bit more intense.
And, Well, we'll talk... that's another podcast.
Yeah.
We could talk about it all day long.
One of the interesting things about Guillotine I thought that was fun to produce is the beginning. You can hear that driving beat that he was talking about on the 2 and 4. And it's always worked really well live because you get the audience stomping it and things like that. You know, it's a lot of fun to do on stage. But in the studio, it just wasn't translating very well. Like, it wasn't coming out...
Flat.
It sounded flat. It sounded like it was just blah, like there was something missing. And so we're up in the studio and they're like, well, we've got some pallets or these boxes we could stomp on. And I'm like, okay, I'll do it. So I sit in there and I'm in the studio.
A couple of them up.
Yeah, they're just like these really heavy wooden boxes and I'm just stomping on them over and over and over again. And I think we did it for like an hour and I bruised my heel. And
he was really into it. Really wanted to.
Layered it on top of each other like 70 times. And yet there was something still missing from it.
And so.
We tried chains. We tried tambourine. We tried mm-hmm. guitar. Like we tried putting everything on top of it because it was still just. It was a little too much bass in there.
Yeah.
Not enough on top.
And so what we did is my brother, who's a drummer and a very talented percussionist. He was visiting for a week, and so we were at the time where the recording, so we invited him into the studio. And
this is like, by the way, this is like a week before we're finished. Like we're wrapping it up, trying to figure out how to like master it now, and it's still not fixed.
And one of the things he said was that, you know, he said like, oh, the stomping feels flat. Try these things. And so we tried him, and then finally we just invited him in the studio, and he was like, well, what if we just shook something?
Do you have like a box?
And so,
do you have like some rocks outside?
Yeah. And so we, well, at first we were using shakers, but shakers again just did not work. And he's like, what if we made a giant shaker? And so we went and found a cardboard box, and he went into the backyard, grabbed a bunch of gravel and dirt, threw it in the box, and then closed the box, and then held it in the studio. And every time on that thump, he would just shake it as hard as he could and just slam it down. And that's where you get that whoosh sound.
Almost sounds like a reverse reverb in there for a minute.
It does.
And that's what it is. It's that box of rocks.
And it was perfect. And like when he was doing it, we were all like, oh, yes. It was great.
If you listen closely, it's almost reminiscent of like a crowd of people like trudging their way to the guillotine.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of what we went for.
That's exactly what I was going for.
It just goes for this like this just, driving motion of like you're reluctantly marching forward, and so that was kind of the idea behind it.
Very cool.
So
long-winded enough for you?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Every song on this album has a story like that behind it. There's always something for everything.
The album was very do-it-yourself.
And it was a lot of fun.
We recorded in a very small, very basic studio with not a lot of gear, not a lot of money. So literally everything we did on the album kind of had a purpose, and we had to do it without, multi-hundred dollar plugins, you know? So like
And I will say this, Columbia Jones, the drummer, he was also the recording engineer.
Yeah.
And he did a fantastic job of getting this all set up and running. He did the initial production and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of handed to me as a partially finished project.
Yeah.
We just went in and polished it off. But he did a fantastic job making something out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The guitar tones that you hear, like all of that, was just tons, hours and hours and hours of fine tweaking and tuning things and making things sound just perfect.
And what's funny is I've always been a big believer that, you know, the album and the live show should coincide with each other. You know, if you sound great on the album but sound like garbage on live, you know, that's an issue. So a lot of the tones that we use in this album are actually tones that I use live with various tweaks, you know, like we would throw in the treble a little bit more. Like I had the chance to sit down in front of my amp a little bit more, and we played around with multi-amp setups and stuff, but we didn't go super crazy.
It was actually really difficult as a producer to work on that, because I would come up with a great idea. Like, what if we do this? He's like, I can't do that live. Oh, fine. Okay, well, let's come up with another idea.
Yeah.
And it actually was a fun challenge to come up with ideas.
I'm the problem child, because again, you know, like the whole stomping thing, we can do that live. We can get the crowd stomping along with us. All those guitar tones that you hear, the various different ones, are literally just differences in pickup configuration, various different distortion fuzz pedals that I'm using on my board at all times. Some people have said that the album sounds, you know, a lot of the tones on the album sound very similar, but honestly, that's kind of, you know, that's just something that we have to kind of work on, you know, as far as our live sound, because at the same time of believing in our live sound, we're also, I try to be a very stripped bare guitarist. I don't like having 30 pedal boards and a million different effects. I'd rather play with 5 pedals and get those pedals to sound perfect and a really great amp and a great guitar, as opposed to having a garbage guitar, a $20 million amp, and a million pedals. You know, I would rather have the three working together in tandem and then have it just bare bones, you know.
Okay.
He's bare bones, but experimental, which made it a challenge.
I like that.
Which is tough. It's really hard to do.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
It was incredibly fun. At the time, it was stressful, but now that I look back on it, I'm like, oh, good times.
Very excited for the next one.
Yeah, the next one's going to be incredible.
Awesome. All right, well, thank you guys for coming down.
Yeah,
it's been awesome.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Listen to the album. Where can people get that if they're interested?
So thecoldyear.com is available. It's thecoldyear.com is linked to all our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our Bandcamp, where you can buy the album.
MySpace, Grindr.
Yeah, MySpace, our Farmers Only account. So you can go there, you can buy the album directly through the website. It's just a Bandcamp plugin that we use. It's really fancy and really nice. But yeah, thecoldyear.com, super easy.
Awesome. All right, well, thanks for coming down.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Good times.
It was fun.